Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. So the question is, do we eat to live or are we living to eat? And that's a question of motivation. And we're talking about motivation today. The question is, what is it that can motivate someone to make a lifestyle change? A physician was once struggling with a women's group. He was trying to help them stop smoking and motivate them to quit. And so he talked to them about lung cancer, emphysema, heart attacks, strokes, bladder cancers, things that you could get from smoking. But they kept chatting in the background. He couldn't get their attention until he'd said something that gripped their hearts with fear. He now had their attention. He had just told them that smoking caused wrinkles. So, what is it that would motivate you to stop smoking? Well, Dean Ornish, he's a physician that did one of the first controlled trials showing reversal of heart disease on a plant-based diet. Did the before and after angiograms showing arteries opening. And because of that, Medicare was willing to pay for his program. Well, he has trouble motivating patients as well because they complain, oh, this is so hard. And he asks them, he says, well, how many of you have one child? And they raise their hands. And he says, how many of you have, oh, he said, then was that hard? He said, oh, yeah, it was the most difficult thing we've done. And he says, how many of you have two or more children? And they raise their hands. And he says, didn't you learn your lesson the first time? Okay, well, they say, well, yes, it was hard, but it was worth it. And we're hoping that if you're making that change or transition to a plant-based diet, you may say, yeah, it's a challenge, but we're hoping you're going to find it's worth it. The Adventist Health Study found that vegetarians live 7 to 10 years longer. Is that motivation? Well, for many, it is. However, these long-lived Adventists can be a problem. I was covering for some partners of mine at the hospital on a weekend, and I saw one of the patients in the intensive care unit. Sometimes they get confused. They get claustrophobic, and he kept asking, oh, well, he was in his 80s. He was at one of our churches up there, so I understood his spiritual background. He said, oh, where's my mother? How's she doing? Well, sir, you know, I'm sorry. She's waiting. She's resting. She's waiting for Jesus to come. She'll be resurrected when they come. He says, oh, she passed away and they didn't tell me. And he was all concerned about it. He says, sir, it's okay. She's all right. She's just waiting for Jesus to come. And so I calmed him down. And then on Monday, his physician, regular physician, came back and he said, any problem with the patients? And he said, oh, no, just the guy in the intensive care unit is asking about his mother, you know. And I told him, she's waiting for Jesus to come. He says, no, she's 102. She's in the nursing home. So I had to backtrack and assure him that his mother was okay in the nursing home. Now, there is this can be a motivation for many people. However, vegetarians also have less disease. And this can be a motivation for older adults. However, younger adults, this usually isn't a motivation for them because they're never going to get old. They're never going to have these problems. And so I have to say something that can get their attention. And so I usually talk about strength and endurance because that's what the guys are concerned about. And then I talk about weight control. That's what many of the girls are concerned about. And then we have their attention. And we're going to talk more about endurance today, and we're going to talk about weight control tomorrow. And I don't want to scare anybody off, but when we talk about weight control, we'll be talking about a group of people that is no more active than the office worker in the United States, yet they weigh 20% less and they eat 30% more. So, want to know how they do that? Come tomorrow. We'll talk about it. Now, there are spiritual reasons also that can be motivation. And these are some that Christians can understand. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have of God? You are not your own, for you are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit. Now, many of you may have borrowed somebody's car before, a friend's car. You get in the car and it's all junky, it's full of trash, and you get on the accelerator and it just kind of chugs along and doesn't really do very well. It's not a joy to drive. But on the other hand, sometimes you get in a new rental car and it smells like it's clean and fresh and brand new, and you put in the accelerator and zoom, you're off and running. And that's a real joy to drive. Well, the Holy Spirit is driving you like a car. He's got many things he wants to accomplish through you. You want to give him a clean car that can respond to what he's asking you to do. And that's part of a healthy living. Also, what we do reflects on God. It says, therefore, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Now, I've got two kids. They're 19, 22 now. I guess I can't call them kids anymore. But they play violins. When they're up there playing their violins, I think, yeah, that's my kids. But when they do something that's maybe not so nice, I say, honey, your kids are doing something. They reflect on us. And so what we do reflects on God. There was once a group of young people arguing about what the best translation of the Bible was. And they talked about this King James and New King James and living translations and paraphrasing. And finally, one guy wasn't saying anything. He was just kind of sitting and listening. And they said, well, what do you think? You know, what do you think the best translation is? And he just said simply, my mother. Well, we may be the only translation people see of the Bible. And so we want to be able to translate it correctly. And our health gives a message of our Creator and our respect for Him and keeping our temples clean. And also, you know, God in the beginning, He created us for joy. He wanted to experience joy in the relationship, and He wanted us to experience joy. And He promises, as His beloved, I pray above all things that you may prosper and be in health just as your soul prospers. So having good health is part of that. So how do you motivate people to make a change? Many times I'll see a patient comes in the office and, you know, I share with him about a healthier lifestyle that can improve his health. He says, I'm too old for it to make a difference. I'm going to talk about that a little bit toward the end of this talk. Is it ever too late to make a change? Noel Johnson, he was 69 in poor health. He was in such poor health, his doctors had plans for him. You know, let's get you in a nursing home so you can pass out your days in peace. His life insurance company had plans for him. We're not selling you any life insurance. You're not going to live long enough to make it worth our while. Was it too late for Noel Johnson? We're going to find out shortly. Eula Weaver, another patient, age 67. She's diagnosed with heart disease and angina. Age 75, had a severe heart attack. Age 81, had congestive heart failure. Her heart was too weak to pump effectively. She couldn't lay flat in bed at night. She'd have to lay sitting up. She couldn't walk more than 100 feet before she had to stop because of pain in her legs, because the arteries were so narrow, she wasn't getting enough blood supply to them. She had to wear gloves in the summer to keep her hands warm because her circulation was so poor. Is there any hope for her? Well, we're going to find out about Eula Weaver in a little bit. What are the benefits of a vegetarian diet? Well, the oldest controlled study in the world was done to answer this very question. Now, what's a controlled trial? Around 1500 BC in Egypt, they used lizard's blood, put it in the ear for an earache. Now, if I told you, yeah, you know, I had an earache, I put some lizard's blood in it, and 2 weeks later, earache was gone, would you believe that lizard's blood was effective in curing earaches? Probably not, okay? Because if I did nothing in 2 weeks, my earache would probably be gone, okay? So you need a control group to compare it with. Control group, you don't do anything to their earaches. The test group, you put lizard's blood in. You see if the lizard's blood, if they get better faster. There was an argument in one of the journals, medical journals, as to when the first controlled trial in medicine was ever done, and they wrote in several suggestions, and they had some in the 1800s. and they published this. And then somebody wrote in later and said, I beg to differ with you. The first controlled trial ever done in medicine was to determine the benefits of a plant-based diet versus the American diet. And it was done 600 years before Christ, and it was recorded in the first chapter of the book of Daniel. And they actually published his response. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story. Daniel's three friends were captives in Babylon. They were from Jerusalem. They were Hebrews. And they were being told to eat the king's rich food because they thought that would make them stronger, smarter, appear nicer. And however, many of these foods were unclean. And some of them were offered to idols. And God had forbidden that they eat these foods. So Daniel's got a problem. How can he stay loyal to his God and not displease the king? So when faced with temptation, what did Daniel do? He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, if you're making lifestyle changes for health reasons, you may be faced with temptation. You got an invitation to neighbor's house. They want to invite you over. How do you handle that? Come up with a plan. Many times you can say, you know, I've got a health problem, and because of that, my doctor wants me on a plant-based diet. Maybe there's a side dish I can have. And so they're not going to be offended. You're not going to be condemning them for not being vegetarian because you're the one with the health problem. It's one tactful way of doing it. There might be an office party you're supposed to be going to, and you'll be tempted with all the foods there. You may want to eat dinner before you go, so you won't be tempted to eat all the food there. But pray about it. Come up with a plan before you go so you can stay in your program. Well, how did the steward respond to this request? Well, he was worried that they were going to look awful and he was going to lose his head. And but Daniel was wise. He said, test this. He says, prove thy servants. For 10 days, give us pulse to eat, that's things grown from seeds, and water to drink. Then let our countenance be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's food or meat. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants. Pulse, things grown from seeds. It's interesting to note that all the third world countries, developing countries, will choose a grain that grows locally and a legume that grows locally. And when you put the two together, you get a nice mix of amino acids to build all the proteins you need, plus plenty of carbohydrates to burn for energy, and a small amount of the fats, the essential fats, that you need to be healthy. In Mexico, corn and beans. China, rice and peas, a grain legume. India, it's a wheat tortilla and lentils. In Ethiopia, it's teff, which is a grain, and garbanzo beans, always a grain and legume. You mix them together. That can be a very simple way of coming up with a vegetarian diet, and then you fill it out with fruits, nuts, and vegetables. What happened? At the end of 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than the young men that ate the king's royal foods, and God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature, wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Interestingly, they found that many, many programs across the United States are finding results in only 10 days. Blood pressure's dropping, weight dropping, blood sugar's dropping in as little as 10 days. The body can actually heal itself if you give it the right foods to do so. Okay, athletes in history. We're going to look at some of the athletes in history. How come? Well, is it because they are good character role models? Actually, most of them aren't. That's not why we're looking at them. We're looking at them because actually they are like scientists. They come up with a hypothesis. They believe that one form of training is going to give them a better performance. And then, like scientists, they're religious in sticking to the program. And then they test their hypothesis in a competition, see how they do. in the 1980s, I was taking a break from medical studies, going through school then, and I happened to see an article, I think it was in Reader's Digest, talking about one man who swam 2.4 miles, biked 112 miles, ran 26.2 miles on 10 bananas. This was a triathlon. I got exhausted just reading about it. By the way, who wants you to know that he did it on 10 bananas? This is the International Banana Association. Okay. Who was the man? Well, you read the fine print at the bottom. It was actually David Scott. And I said, well, I grew up with a David Scott in Davis, California. I wonder if it's the same one. And it actually was. At that time, he had blue ribbons for swimming. A group of us boys, we lived about 3 miles outside of town, and we would ride our bicycles from our houses into town to school every day. And that was kind of fun. And so I called him up. I said, what were you eating before you ran? He says, I was a vegetarian 3 years before I ran my first race. I thought, well, that's interesting. Is this a coincidence, or is there a cause and effect relationship here? Okay, who's this? Tarzan. Okay, I know how old you are now. Okay, yeah, Tarzan. Actually, Hollywood had several Tarzans. He was their favorite, not because of his acting. His acting was really poor, but he was genuine. He was a world-class swimmer. He had set 56 world records at the time of our story today. By the way, you know how he got into swimming? He came over from Austria when he was about 7 or 8. He was diagnosed with polio around 10 years of age, and the doctor told him, his mother, get him in the pool. The weight of the water can support his body, and he can exercise, and, you know, hopefully maybe he can get through life okay. Well, he took to swimming, and he persisted, and set world records. So, again, don't let setbacks or apparent setbacks hold you back from what God's calling you to do in your life. Well, now, owing to age, he had not set any records for 5 years. He had been an omnivore his whole life. Omnivore means eating everything. Weissmiller was invited by Dr. Kellogg to the newly rebuilt Battle Creek Sanitarium to perform at the dedication of the sanitarium's new swimming pool. Kellogg started him on a strictly no-meat diet for several weeks. He stuck with the diet, and in a few weeks, on a meatless diet, he established 6 more world records after 5 years of nothing. Again, I thought, is this a coincidence or is there a cause-effect relationship here? Murray Rose, youngest triple gold medalist in Olympic history. He'd been a vegetarian since 2 years of age, never been beaten when swimming in his own age group. In a foreign country, he would leave the Olympic camp to eat a vegetarian meal at an Adventist hospital. Because wherever you go in the world, you'll find 2 things, Coca-Cola and Adventist hospitals. Okay, so they're there. Again, it's a cause and effect relationship. Because I grew up thinking meat was essential for strength and endurance. All that's what you need to perform well. And I thought, well, where did we get this concept? We actually got it from the Greeks. The Greeks, we got a lot of actually misconceptions from the Greeks. Aristotle, who was a Greek, taught that spiders had 6 legs. And this was believed for hundreds of years until somebody actually bothered to count them, found out they had 8. Okay. The ancient Greek athletes, were heavy meat eaters. Milo of Croton was a legendary Greek wrestler, never once brought to his knees in over 5 Olympiads. He supposedly consumed gargantuan amounts of meat. So the Greek concept of the importance of meat for performance still lingers today. In the mid-1800s, Dr. Justus von Liebig, a preeminent physiological chemist, advocated that all energy for muscular movement came from protein. The typical meatless diet was thought to contain insufficient amounts of protein for performance. Vegetarians were thus thought to be incapable of prolonged exercise. Well, this idea was challenged by the London Vegetarian Society, which formed an athletic and cycling club. James Parsley, that's a good name for a vegetarian, he and the other 90 members vindicated their diet by outperforming their carnivorous competitors in the bicycle races. A week later, he won the most prestigious hill climbing race in England, breaking the record by nearly a minute. In America, Will Brown, a cyclist and vegetarian for health reasons, thrashed all records for the 2,000-mile bicycle race. Margarita Gast, also a vegetarian, established the women's record for the 1,000-mile bike race. 1893, the 372-mile long-distance walking race from Berlin to Vienna, the first two places were vegetarians. Then in 1912, vegetarian Kolmanen became one of the first men to complete the marathon in under 2 hours and 30 minutes. By 1985, almost 30 marathon runners were listed as using a plant-based diet. And now, these are anecdotal cases, and most people in medicine, anyone, want controlled trials. So there were controlled trials. The first ones began in 1904. The Belgian researcher, Dr. Schoutenden, he divided 25 students into vegetarians and meat-eating groups. Then he measured their endurance. Simple test. They squeezed a hand exerciser, and they counted the number of squeezes they could do before exhaustion. The meat-eaters averaged about 38. Vegetarians averaged 69, almost double the endurance. In the early 1900s, Dr. Irving Fisher, one of America's leading educators, he wanted to prove Dr. Kellogg wrong. He wanted to show Dr. Kellogg the advantages of eating meat. Fisher did an endurance experiment with 49 persons, vegetarians and carnivores. And those using the vegetarian diet had much greater endurance than those that were the meat eaters. One of Fisher's tests was a simple test, just hold your arms out. And in the red there, the red bar, you see that 2 out of the 15 meat eaters lasted 15 minutes, whereas 70% of the vegetarians lasted 15 minutes. And you see that about 50% of the vegetarians lasted 30 minutes, but none of the meat eaters lasted 30 minutes. And at 3 hours, you've got one lone vegetarian, okay, still holding his arms out. They also did deep knee bends, and they counted the number. Omnivores averaged about 1,000. Vegetarians averaged about 2,000. Now, this isn't, you know, a 2% or 4% difference. This is 100% difference. This is, you know, an order of magnitude greater endurance. And lastly, another anecdotal event here. There was a spam test. Canadian Marines were doing 10 to 15 mile per day forced marches, and they were on a mixed diet. And they would get the end of their march and set up camp. Then they changed their diet to emergency rations, which was pemmican, or we would call it Spam, meat and fat in a can. And they ate that for a day. At the end of the day, they came straggling into camp. No fires were started. They just collapsed and went to sleep. The next morning, they were still exhausted. They were so exhausted, they had to cancel the next forced march. One of the sergeants there said, you know, 2 days ago, we had a crack set of troops. Today, they are totally unfit for combat. So, why do vegetarians have more endurance? And actually, there is a reason. The reason is called glycogen. What is glycogen? Glycogen is a starch. What is a starch? A starch is, if you take a little circle, you see one of those hexagon shapes there? That's a sugar. And when you string those sugars together in a long string, you get a starch. And that's the way your liver stores energy. If you stop eating today, right now, you would live off the starch in your liver for about 24 hours. It's like a gas tank. At the end of 24 hours, you'll run out of glycogen in your liver. Then you start going into starvation, where you break down muscle and fat, and that's the starvation cycle. So the liver prevents you from going into starvation. Also, you store glycogen in your muscles themselves. Now, when you're walking, you have enough fat to, well, when you're walking, you can burn fat fast enough to maintain walking. But if I start running, I can't burn fat fast enough to maintain running. So I have to burn the second supply of energy of fat plus glycogen, and that can maintain running. So I have enough fat to go walking a third of the way across the United States. That's 1,000 miles. But running, I only have enough glycogen in an untrained runner to go 20 miles. That's why marathons are 26 miles. They go 6 miles beyond the point at which most people run out of their glycogen and hit the wall where they have to stop running and start walking. So many athletes, marathon runners, triathletes, will eat a big spaghetti meal before the race, high starch meal, to try to fill up those glycogen stores before the race. Does this actually make a difference, or is this just folklore? Well, in 1967, Scandinavian researchers asked that question and did a test to find out. They took one group of people, same group of people, and they put them on three different diets. And they had a couple of weeks between each diet to allow a washout. First diet was high-fat and protein diet consisting of meat, eggs, milk, and cheese. Basically, just a meat and dairy diet. Then they tested them. Then they had a washout period. Then they put them on a mixed diet consisting of animal products and fruits, nuts, grains, and vegetables together. And then they tested them. And then they had a washout period where they stabilized them again. Then the third diet was a high complex carbohydrate diet consisting of 80% of the calories from carbohydrates, essentially a vegetarian diet. Then they tested them the last time. Now, how did they test them? They actually put a needle in the muscle and they pulled out a core of tissue and they measured the glycogen in the muscle. And if you see on the, if you see that on the very far right of the screen, on the meat and dairy diet, they had 0.6 grams of glycogen per 100 grams of muscle tissue. Very little. On the mixed diet, it rose from 0.6 to 1.8. Three times increase. And on the vegetarian diet, it went from 0.6 to 3.6. Six times more glycogen than on the meat and dairy diet, and twice as much glycogen as on the mixed diet. So, do you think that would make a difference in strength and endurance? Well, they said, we think it would. If these were horses in a horse race, you'd probably want to bet on the high glycogen horse. But, So they tested them to find out. More glycogen. What they did, they put them on a bicycle ergometer, and they tested them on the meat and dairy diet. They went about an hour before exhaustion. On the mixed diet, they went almost 2 hours before exhaustion. And on the vegan diet, they went essentially 3 hours before exhaustion. An incredible increase in endurance. Since then, they've done other tests. Here we see what happens to the glycogen on a mixed diet. This is an American diet. In 3 days of running 10 miles. So on day one, before they start, their average glycogen is around 1.8. After the run, it dropped to about 1.45. Then they get a good night's sleep. They eat their meals. They get up the next day, and their glycogen hasn't been restored that much. And then they run the second day, and the glycogen gets depleted again. And then they run the third day, and it gets depleted again. If you notice, after each run, the glycogen on the mixed diet is not getting restored the way it should. And so after 3 days, it actually took them 2 days before their glycogen stores would come back up to what it was before they started running. However, compare that to the glycogen levels of someone on a high complex carbohydrate diet. Notice that on the complex carbohydrate diet, the vegetarian diet, the glycogen stores are being restored after each run. And so endurance athletes are finding that for endurance, plant-based diet is what gives them the strength and endurance to have those long training days. How long will it take to replace the glycogen stores after a glycogen-depleting exercise? Well, it takes about 20 hours. With optimal carbohydrate intake, carbohydrate stores are replenished at a rate of about 5 to 7% per hour. What about eating during a race? It's a common practice. They find that if you're training at 60 to 80% of your maximum predicted heart rate, you can postpone fatigue about 15 to 30 minutes with carbohydrate feedings during the race. The problem with that is that your digestive tract is designed to have a meal and then rest for 4 to 5 hours so the juices can be reaccumulated in the glands and so you can properly digest your food. There's actually a washout cycle in your stomach that occurs between meals, and if you eat frequently, you're going to eliminate that. So how do you get this benefit without eating during a race? Actually, a complex carbohydrate diet of legumes in the morning can actually give you that slow release of sugar throughout the day without having to eat every 15, 20 minutes or every hour or so. This is a test they did to test foods before a race and endurance. What they found is that eating a sugary snack, is that going to help or hinder in endurance? They actually found it hindered endurance. They found that if you eat a sugary meal before the race, what happens is your blood sugar shoots up, your pancreas overreacts, it releases a lot of insulin. That insulin goes into the cells and opens the cell doors. The sugar leaves the blood, goes in the cell and gets burned, and that brings your sugar down. Problem is, on a sugary meal, your pancreas overreacts and your blood sugar drops too low. Usually you get hypoglycemic maybe 90 minutes to 2 hours later, and you get hungry again. If this happens during a race and your blood sugars drop too low because of a sugary meal before the race, you're going to burn up your glycogen stores faster, and they found it reduced your endurance. On the other hand, they found that if they ate something like a low glycemic meal of lentils or beans or something of this nature, the legume family are the lowest glycemic index foods. Those foods will go in the gut. They'll be absorbed slowly over 5-6 hours. If you eat those at, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, you're not going to get hungry till about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, about six hours later. And it will, they found in this case, it actually increased strength and endurance. So let's ask some of the athletes what they eat. What did David Scott eat when he set those world records? He cooked up 2 pounds of brown rice, leaves it on the stove all day. He eats it throughout the day with yogurt, vegetables, and 20 pieces of fruit per day. This gives him all the calories he needs for those 8-hour training days and replenishes the glycogen stores in the muscles for the next day. An 80% carbohydrate diet needs continuous carbohydrate loading. This is a quote from him. He says, over the past 7 years, this is back in 1980s, I've been following a strict but enjoyable diet. I do enjoy eating of approximately 10% of my calories from fat, 15% protein, and 75% complex carbohydrates. This diet has undoubtedly contributed to my athletic performance in the triathlons. Over the last 5 years, the total reduction of fat and cholesterol with an increase in muscle and liver glycogen through a higher carbohydrate diet has enabled me to train for 5 to 8 hours daily and compete at a world-class level. Did David Scott understand this glycogen concept? Actually, he majored in exercise physiology in college, so he actually knew what he was doing. Now, his parents, they freaked out when they heard he was going to be a vegetarian. They didn't understand, but he tried it, and it did pay off. They polled triathletes in the 80s, asked them what their preferred diet was, and about half the athletes chose Pritikin diet, which is a form of a vegetarian diet, as their number one choice. One of the concerns we have for bodybuilders and people wanting to maintain their strength is they're worried that they cannot maintain their muscle mass on a high carbohydrate, relatively low protein diet. Can you maintain that musculature on a vegetarian diet? Actually, yes, you can. This was shown in a in the ultra endurance running competition by Kouras. This is a race where they run 600 miles, and Kouras did it in 5 days, 5 hours, and 7 minutes. They just run until they're exhausted. They take a brief nap. They get up, and they run again. What they did is they measured his calorie and food intake, and he ate a total of 55,970 calories, of which 95% was carbohydrates, 3% lipids, and 1.7% protein, essentially a low-protein diet. And they did body composition tests before and after the race. His muscle mass did not change during that five-day race. So, yes, it is possible. And the other thing to share with people that are concerned about this, the strongest animals on Earth are vegetarians, the bulls, the elephants, the gazelles. Last time I asked the bull, I said, aren't you concerned about, you know, this grass? Aren't you going to get enough? Where are you going to get your protein from? Well, he's not too concerned about it. He gets plenty of protein from the plants that they're eating. Cheetahs are carnivores. They're one of the fastest animals, or mammals anyway. And however, after about 100 yards, they're done, okay? They've used up their energy and they're exhausted. Now, if the cheetah would change his diet to a vegetarian diet, he could possibly prolong that. Lions also, if they don't catch their meal in the first few hundred yards, they're done. Their endurance is not that great. And so to catch their prey, the male lions will center over here. They'll see the gazelles here. And the female lions will go on the other side of the gazelles. Then the males will get up and they'll roar. They'll scare the gazelles into the waiting female lions. That's the only way they can catch their food. Because if it was just an endurance test of them chasing a gazelle miles and miles, they never catch them. Vegan weightlifters, bodybuilders maintain lean body mass. If 11% of their calories are from protein, and strength athletes were able to do it with 15% of their calories from protein. Can a vegan diet do this? Actually, yes, it can. Fruits are fairly low in protein, but if you mix the fruits with nuts and seeds, you can increase the protein content. Again, fruits, 6.7% of calories from proteins, nuts and seeds, 11%. But when you get to the grains, it's 13%. And if you mix those with vegetables and beans, 28% of the calories from proteins, you're going to get plenty of protein. And in America, actually, the problem isn't a lack of protein. The problem is getting too much protein. And that's a whole different discussion. But too much protein can cause significant problems. A Yale test looking at strength. Yale took 11 soldiers, 8 university athletes in the pink of condition, and they cut their meat intake by a third for 6 months. Dynamometer tests were done before and after and showed an actual doubling of the soldier's strength and an increase in the athlete's strength as well. And then we get to the Tarahumara Indians. These are an interesting group of people. They live in Ute Aztecan tribe. They live in the Sierra Madre Occidental Mountains in the northern central state of Chihuahua, Mexico. They've been studied extensively because they have incredible endurance. Here are two of them in the Leadville 100-mile race held annually in Colorado. These are the first two places were Tarahumara Indians. They can carry loads 80% of their weight, 110 miles in 70 hours. They can run 500 miles in 5 days to deliver a letter. Adult men have a kickball game where they run 90 to 180 miles in about 24 to 48 hours, an incredible distance. Women also have a kickball game, but they have other duties. They have to take care of the kids. They have to cook the meals. So their game, they only run 50 miles. Okay, can you imagine? What do they eat? Mainly corn and beans. 11% of the calories from fat, whereas in the United States, we're about 40% fat. 2% of the calories from saturated fat, that's usually the animal fats. 15% of the calories are from fats in the United States. The polyunsaturated fat to saturated fat ratio, that's the plant fats to animal fats ratio, is high in the Tarahumara Indians, over 2, and it's very low in the United States, about 0.35 or less. Cholesterol intake, 71 milligrams per day for the Tarahumara Indians, and it's 500-750 in the U.S. Now, you can only get cholesterol from animal products. The Tarahumara Indians do eat a small amount of deer meat. Do you know how they hunt their deer? They run them into exhaustion. They chase the deer until the deer collapses. 5% of their calories come from simple sugars. Do they have our diseases? Actually, no. Average cholesterol for men is 136. In America, it's about 200. And for women, it's about 117. They don't have high blood pressure and they don't have obesity. So, that's the best diet for strength and endurance. How do you train? Well, there's sort of a technical way of calculating how to train. If you take 220 minus your age, that would be your maximum predicted heart rate. That's the heart rate that you could achieve if you're running away from a lion. The highest training rate is recommended to be 80% of that maximum, and the lowest training rate to be 60%. So if you go from 60 to 80, that's a good training rate. But that's kind of complicated. You almost need a little pulse meter on your wrist to do that. There's a simpler way to do it. If you're doing a walking program, if you're walking and you're gasping for air, you're going too fast. On the other hand, if you can talk like I'm talking to you without any shortness of breath, you're going too slow. You need to walk to where you're a little bit short of breath when you're talking to somebody. And that's a simple way to test. Are there benefits to exercise? Well, yes, there are. Dr. Blair, I wanted to find out what those benefits were. He looked at 13,000 men, and he wondered what their heart disease death rates were. And sure enough, heart disease death rates were 8 times greater in the poor aerobic fitness group compared to those that exercised. But that wasn't too surprising, but what was surprising was cancer death rates dropped dramatically when they were exercising. They found the cancer death rates were several times higher in the poor aerobic fitness group. We also know that women, if they've been treated for breast cancer, if they've survived breast cancer, their risk of recurrence is cut in half if they exercise, if they're on an exercise program. Does exercise actually increase longevity? It actually does. They looked at Harvard graduates, Harvard University alumni who exercise regularly, live 2.2 years longer than their inactive alumni. Now, I want to give you a perception of what that 2.2 years looks like. If I was to get rid of cancer in the United States, totally eliminate it, the average lifespan would increase by 2.2 years. On the other hand, if I could get everybody to walk 30 minutes a day, 5 or 6 days a week, the average lifespan would increase 2.2 years. Okay. How much money is spent trying to get rid of cancer? What, billions? How much money is spent trying to get you to walk 30 minutes a day? What, zero? And yet, both of them have the same benefits in terms of increasing your lifespan. Okay, so at what age would changing to a vegetarian lifespan or lifestyle be useless? When is it too late? Well, you remember Eula Weaver described her in the beginning of her talk. At age 67, she developed heart disease. She had chest pain because the arteries supplying her heart were too narrow, not giving her enough blood. Every time she walked up the stairs, she'd get chest pain. At age 75, she had a severe heart attack, ended up in the hospital. Age 81, she had congestive heart failure. That's where the heart has become too weak to pump blood effectively. She has to sleep sitting up to keep her lungs clear. She gets short of breath walking across the room. She gets chest pain. She has high blood pressure, arthritis, claudication. That means the arteries in the legs are too narrow to supply the muscles adequately, so she can only go 100 feet before she gets the pain is so severe she has to stop. She had to wear gloves in the summer to keep her hands warm because her circulation is so poor. What hope does she have? Well, many of us, if we saw her in the office, would just put her in a nursing home, keep her comfortable until she passes on. What did she do? She actually read Pritikin's program at age 81, and she started a plant-based diet. After a year, they had to take her off her medications because her blood pressure dropped too low, and they had to get her off her medications. She lost all her symptoms, and she started walking. She could walk up to a mile. At age 85 and a half, she had started running, and she entered the Senior Olympics. She ran the 800 and 1500 meter dash and won 2 gold medals. She ran these races for 6 years and won 12 gold medals. She holds the record in the 800 meter dash in the 85 to 89 year old age group, and in the 1500 meter dash in the 85 to 89 year old age group, and in the 90 to 94-year-old age group. Now, I don't know how much competition she has, but she's running those races, okay? And that's amazing. So it wasn't too late for Eula to change her lifestyle at age 81. Remember Noel Johnson, age 69. Didn't have much for the future, hope for the future. Doctor has plans for him because he's in such poor health. He recommended a nursing home. He couldn't buy any life insurance. What did he do? At age 70, he began his own rehab program of diet and exercise. He changed his diet. No meat, no cheese, no eggs, no butter, no margarine, no oils. And we talk about the importance of getting rid of the free oils as well later on. Essentially a plant food diet with a small amount of animal protein, fish once or twice a week, which he didn't need, but that was what he tried. At age 71, he ran a 6-minute, 27-second mile, very fast. At age 73, he ran the Pikes Peak Marathon. He ran the New York Marathon at ages 80, 82, and 83. Noel wrote, he says, "I know your way of life is stated in your book, free from so many damaging oils, has helped me to obtain the physical condition I have at age 83. So, wasn't too late for Noel. And lastly, we want to look at Amazing Mavis. Who was she? Well, as a child, she suffered a whooping cough and pneumonia, which weakened her lungs. As an adult, she had recurrent episodes of bronchitis. In her early 60s, she was 20 pounds overweight due to years of inactivity. Then she heard a lecture by Dr. Charles Thomas in her early 60s, and she began walking every day. She walked a short distance at first, then she increased the distance, she added jogging, she lost the 20 extra pounds, and her lung problems disappeared. She built up to 5 miles of jogging per day, 6 days a week. Now, her son was a medical doctor, and he did something very nice for her. He entered her into the Avenue of the Giants Marathon. Don't you all wish you had a son that would do that for you? Okay. Can you imagine? Training more than 50 miles a week in preparation for her first marathon, Mavis successfully completed the 26.2-mile event, setting an age group world record. Since then, she's done 60 full marathons, fastest time, 4 hours, 34 minutes. In the fall of 1984, she established the best time for women over age 70. She became the oldest woman to run to the race to the top of Pikes Peak in Colorado. Mavis maximizes her training by eating a high-carbohydrate vegetarian diet that helps restore muscle glycogen levels for the next training bout. At age 80, she has a VO2 max equivalent to a body of a woman in college, 58 years younger. VO2 max, what is that? That's the best measure we have of your cardiovascular fitness. It measures the volume of oxygen you can burn per minute. You need a special machine. By the way, we're going to be getting one of those machines that you will be able to use it during lifestyle programs here. And if you want to check yours out, talk to me. Maybe we can do that during one of the lifestyle sessions. Anyway, her VO2 max was essentially like a college woman's. Her body fat was 12%. The average college woman's was 25%. Breathing capacity typically declines with age as you get older. But her breathing capacity was 40% above that of a woman, of that predicted for a woman her age. Sports Illustrated calls her Amazing Mavis, but as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, she gives God the glory. So, quiz. What is, now did you know there's going to be a quiz? Would you have come if you'd known? Would you? Okay. What is the best diet for endurance? Yeah, vegetarian diet, okay. And can exercise prolong your life? Yeah, 2.2 years. Is it ever too late to change your diet and start an exercise program?
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.